Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about The Great Scientists, I think, episode 3. And we've done Galileo, and I think we've done Newton. How are we, or is Newton coming up? Hooke? It'll have to be Newton. Oh, Newton's coming up. So this is Christian Huygens' wave packets. There's another scientist, sort of famous scientist, on the tip of my tongue, which I'm really trying to remember. It's probably not him. So I'm going to read about him. He's from 1692 to 1693. So died in his 60s, I expect. That's 164. Okay, one of the few scientists in the late 17th century with a stature approaching that of Newton, Christian Huygens, 1629 to 1693, was famed for the invention of the pendulum clock, the first accurate clock, and such astronomical discoveries as Saturn's moon Titan. Huygens lived at a time when science was just beginning to make its mark in the world. The greatest mind in Europe were caught up in the fever of scientific discovery. This is a time when Newton discovered gravity and the basic rules govern the earthly every movement of the universe. In the time when Newton and Leibniz created the mathematics of calculus, when Hooke and Leeuwenhoek discovered the world of the microscopic life, Huygens was at the forefront of the scientific revolution and lived in the hub of northwest Europe. When Huygens was a young boy growing up in the Netherlands, Galileo was being threatened with torture by papal authorities in Rome for suggesting the Earth might not be fixed in the centre of the universe. Well, that's technically not correct. Yeah, you know, that's just bollocks. Yet not long after, Huygens was writing, quote, "We shall be less apt to admire what the world calls great when we know that there are a multitude of such earths inhabited and adorned as well as our own," end quote. Such sentiments would not sound out of place coming from the mouth of an astronomer today. Like so many scientists of the day, Huygens' interests were wide-ranging. Like Hooke and Leeuwenhoek, he made his own microscope and made important discoveries in the microscopic world. He made his own astronomical telescopes, which were technically superior to anything that had gone before. With them, he discovered Saturn's moons, Titans, and the nature of Saturn's rings, mapped the surface of Mars for the first time, identified stars within the Orion Nebula, and discovered a number of other nebula. So nebula means cloud, and Orion Nebula. So the Orion constellation is the three belts, the Saucepan, and the nebula is, I think, if you look down the middle star of the sword of the belt, not those three big stars across, those middle star is the Orion's nebula. Okay, above all, the constellation Orion. Above all, though, Huygens is famous for two crucial ideas. First of all, he invented the pendulum clock, the world's first accurate timekeeper, and explored the mathematics associated with pendulums, which led him and Hooke to the early prediction of a link between elliptical orbits of planets and the inverse square law of gravity. Huygens is also famous for the proposition of the wave theory of light, known as Huygens' construction, which outlined in the Treatise on Light in 1690, a few years before his death. This gave a much better explanation than Newton's rival particle theory for the way light is reflected and refracted, predicted incorrectly that light must travel more slowly in denser material. Newton's status ensured Huygens' wave theory was neglected until the 19th century, when Englishman Thomas, that's a bit interesting, so the wave, that's an important thing that the wave theory does predict. However, the wave theories is important for refractive index. Thomas Young conducted experiments that seemed to prove a wave-like structure of light, Young's slit experiment. Now scientists accept light can have both particle and wave, but Huygens had been well and truly vindicated. What I was going to say is that particle and wave is due to flawed science. If you only have particle detectors, that's what you will detect. Okay, my little Archimedes, born on the 14th of April, 1629, in a grand house of Hague, the Hague, Hawkins grew up in a sophisticated environment. His father, Constantine, was liberal to the Dutch Republic, as well as a poet, composer, and patron of the arts. There was always a string of distinguished visitors in the house at Plien, including English poet John Donne, he's a dreadful poet, painter Rembrandt, and most significantly, the great philosophy mathematician René Descartes. This is very interesting. I'm surprised that Descartes is not in this list of scientists. Such as the galaxy of talent, the young Christian had plenty of role models, and he developed a lifelong love of learning, spanned languages, music, law, engineering, and above all, mathematics. His father called him Mon Archimède, but it wasn't all books, for he became an excellent card player, dab hand at billiards, and a top-class rider. At the age of 16, the young Huygens went to the University of Leiden, where he began to study mathematics and law in earnest. After 2 years at Leiden, he continued his studies at the University of Breda, and he was already beginning to make his name for himself through his correspondence with the great French mathematician Martin Mersenne Primes Mersenne quite a lot from Mersenne Primes and pseudo-random numbers, and later in his own elegant treatise on the joy of major mathematical problems. Stargazing. Soon, however, Huygens' attentions turned to the sky. He began to develop better ways of grinding and polishing lenses for telescopes. And it was not long before he was building some of the most powerful lens telescopes of the day. Using one of these telescopes, he discovered the moon. So it's not a Newtonian telescope, which is a reflective telescope. This is a lens telescope. It's interesting. A moon Titan in March 1655. That year, he made his first trip to Paris, where he met some of the most distinguished thinkers of the day. Back in Holland the following year, Huygens was able to see the true nature of Saturn's rings. They were indeed narrow bands of rings around the planet and appeared to change shape simply because we see them from Earth at different angles. Astronomers with inferior telescopes could not accept this description at first, but as telescopes improved, Huygens was seen as right. Working in astronomy demanded accurate timekeeping, and that year Huygens developed a pendulum clock. See the box on page 48, and which was the next page. As described in his famous book, Horologium, in 1658, Society and the Man. By now, Huygens' reputation was beginning to spread, and when he returned to Paris in 1660, he was something of a celebrity. He met the great French mathematician Basile Pascal, Pascal's distribution, Cavari, Sobery. Huygens wrote to his brother that there was, quote, a meeting every Tuesday when 20 or 30 illustrious men were found together. I never failed to go. And in 1661, he went to England to find out more about the newly founded Royal Society. While in London, he showed the English scientists his telescopes, and they were suitably impressed. Huygens, in turn, was impressed with Hooke's air pump and Boyle's experiments with it, and soon began his own air pump experiments. 2 years later, Huygens was invited to join the Royal Society. Then, in 1666, which I think is the Great Fire, Huygens was invited to become one of the founding members of the French equivalent of the Royal Society, the Académie Royale des Sciences. He moved to Paris, very soon becoming a leading figure in the Academy, and by 1672 was the president, a unique honour for a Dutchman. So that's a long way off the revolution. Huygens remained in Paris for 15 years, and it proved to be one of his most productive periods of his life. It was during this time that he developed theories on light, and also further developed his pendulum clock to try and create a timepiece accurate enough to use on ships, and solve the problem of demanding longitude. He developed a magic lantern, the ancestor of the modern film projectors, and an engine powered by gunpowder. He was also said to have taught mathematics and later famous scientist to the later famous scientist Leibniz. So Leibniz is such an amazing person. I'm really struggling to remember this very. I've got to go in. Sorry, I'm back again after that little break. There's the telephone. I had to try and go in and get it. And it's... while walking around getting my hat in the sun and stuff like that, I was able to remember the other famous scientist who's not Huygens, but Herschel. And I wonder if he's in this book. Very interesting scientist to go around. But let's go back. So we finished that he was a society man of the Royal Society, the equivalent of the French Academy, and taught Leibniz, who's the competitor to Newton, so he's pre-health. All the time, though, Huygens was continuously plagued by illness. In 1670, he had to return briefly to Holland, believing himself close to death. While lying ill in his bed, he called for the English ambassador to give him his papers, for mechanics, saying the Royal Society was assembled the choicest of Christendom, and that he would sooner deposit my little labours in their hands than anywhere else. Huygens survived by this time, returned to Paris, but his health became increasingly frail. Should I cough? By 1681, Huygens was so ill that he was forced to give up his position at the French Academy and return to The Hague. He made his return visit to London in 1689 and met Newton there. Huygens and Newton both admired one another. Newton described Huygens as the most elegant mathematician of the age, but on many points they did not agree. Newton thought that light was made of particles, while Huygens thought it moved in waves. Even more crucially, Huygens was not convinced of Newton's theory of universal gravitation. I esteem his understanding and subtlety highly, but I consider they have been put to ill use through the greater part of his work, where the author studies things of little use, or when he builds on improbable principle of attraction. Like Galileo, Huygens thought the idea of an invisible force just too fanciful. Yeah, this is it, that gravity is an invisible force, and it is fanciful because it's actually space bending. It's amazing that mass can actually bend space. The final frontier. Huygens returned to isolation in Holland again and spent much of his time contemplating the nature of the universe. His ideas culminated in a book called Cosmos Theoros, which he translated from Latin into English in 1698. The celestial worlds discovered, or conjectures concerning inhabitants, plants, and productions on the world in the planets. The extraordinary book was the first serious scientific work on the idea of a gigantic universe populated with so many suns, so many earths. How must our wonder and admiration be increased, he wrote. We consider the most prodigious distance and multitude of stars. Even more startling were Huygens' discussions of the possibility of extraterrestrial life. Quote, a man that is of Copernicus's opinion that the Earth is ours is a planet, carried round and lightened by the sun, and the rest of them cannot but sometimes fantasy that it's not improbable that the rest of the planets have their dress and furniture, nay, their inhabitants too well, as this Earth does, especially if one considers the later discoveries since made in Copernicus's time of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. As you can imagine seeing that. So that's an important point. The book was much admired at the time, but taken 3 centuries for scientists to get the positions where they can seriously investigate the possibility of extraterrestrial life. Cosmos Theoros was Huygens' last work, and was published posthumously. In the 1690s, for Huygens, had become marked by rapidly deteriorating health and depression. He died after considerable suffering in March 1693, so he's still not immune from depression. And let's read the little thing, Huygens and Time. Galileo's first alerted the world to timekeeping possibilities was a swinging pendulum, but it was Huygens who successfully tied it with the escapement mechanism and a weight and gear that kept the clock's hand moving to create the first pendulum clock described in horologium. The clocks using falling weights and gears were already wide use, but they were wildly inaccurate, losing and gaining at least 50 minutes a day. Huygens' pendulum clock could be accurate within a minute or so a week. Huygens was not slow to realize the commercial potential, and within the year had arranged for such clocks to be made under license. In just a few years, the pendulum clock was being used for timekeeping across northern Europe. It was a crucial invention not only for the world in general, but also for the progress of science. But Huygens himself was not so far. He wanted to make the clock that kept perfect time for it to be carried aboard ship and used in making longitudinal measurements. Any gain or loss of time could lead to a huge miscalculation of position. Very large pendulum clocks in scientific establishments could be about accurate enough, but it was thoroughly impractical to take such a clock on a ship. So Huygens set about working out why small pendulum clocks were inaccurate. Huygens discovered the simple pendulum is not actually a perfect timekeeper at all. In fact, it completes smaller, faster swings than bigger swings, and so this asynchronous keeping equal time doesn't keep equal time. It's not a sequence. Any variation in the size of the swing would make the clock gain or lose time. Huygens realized this because the way of the bob and the pendulum followed a circular path. Brilliantly, he showed mathematically in his great book, Holographic Oscillation, that if the bob's path was a cycloid instead of a circle, it would be asynchronous no matter what the length of a swing. So what does that mean? I really miss... What does that mean? What is a cycloid? A cycloid is a path... it's a cycloid is a part in a spinning disc where the disc is bigger. I don't understand it. Ewan's inventive genius enabled him to go further and make pendulum swings cycloidal by suspending a rigid pendulum rod on two cords that were swinging either way, was limited by two plates called cycloidal checks. Despite extensive trials, however, Huygens' cycloidal pendulums never quite worked in practice. And it was another 100 years before English clockmaker John Harrison made a sufficiently accurate, robust chronometer to use at sea to solve the longitudinal problem. So what does cycloidal mean? I really don't quite understand it. But if the clock itself was not a total success, Huygens' theoretical work was a milestone in science, playing a key part in the understanding of centrifugal force, which is complete bollocks. It also laid the groundwork for Newton's laws of motion by showing how an object will travel in a straight line unless pulled onto a curved pipe by some other force. In 1675, Huygens introduced another great innovation into timekeeping, the spiral balance spring. As a swinging pendulum regulates the motion of a clock, so the spring balance regulates the motion of a balance wheel in a watch. A balance wheel is a finely balanced wheel that rotates to keep a watch mechanism operating. The spiral balance spring controlled the rotation so well that watches could keep time within a day per year. Within a few years, watches were being carried by gentlemen pockets. So this is the spiral spring. I can't see it as a major invention, but I'm sort of just... And just checking here. 49.50. Okay. Anton von Leeuwenhoek, 1832 to 1723, lived another good old 90 years, is one of the most unassuming scientists who ever lived, spending his long life in Delft, where he was a draper. But in his back room, he discovered an entirely new world, the world of the microscopic life, including bacteria, protozoa, nematodes, rotifers, and human sperm, and blood cells. He said... He wanted to get his sperm. He said, I did not enjoy getting the sperm out of myself. Until Leeuwenhoek started to work on his microscope, no one suspected that any kind of life too small to see is the naked eye. Fleas were thought to be the smallest possible form of life, and they were clearly visible to the sharp eye. No one had an inkling that there could be anything smaller. Then the microscope was invented. No one knows quite who invented it. Craftsmen were probably using drops of water and rock crystals to magnify the work for thousands of years. But the credit for creating a special apparatus to magnify usually goes to the Dutch spectacle maker of the late 16th century called Zacharias Janssen. He was skilled in grinding glass made to magnify, and his breakthrough was to put two lenses together to dramatically increase magnification. But Leeuwenhoek only had one lens, as far as I know. Look at it. Scientists soon began to catch on to possibilities, and Jensen's microscope made improvements to it. In 1665, the great English scientist Robert Hooke published a book called Micrographium, in which he explained the basic principles of microscopy, and which contained the first drawing of any living cell, which had been a tiny living cell, which is seen inside a soil quart. But it never occurred to the scientist of the day to look for life in the microscope elsewhere. It could not be seen with the naked eye. They simply used their microscopes to study such things as skin in close-up, or corks or hairs. Leeuwenhoek's brilliant insight was to use the microscope to look at all kinds of places where he could not see life with the naked eye, particularly liquids, and he studied the extraordinary range of things with his microscope, raindrops to tooth pluck, dung, sperm, blood, and many others besides. It was these apparently lifeless substances that Leeuwenhoek discovered a teeming richness of microscopic life. The humble draper. Leeuwenhoek was born in Delft in 24th of October 1632, of quite humble origins. His father was a basket maker and his mother's family were brewers. Very little is known about his childhood. He walked to school to the nearby town of Wormald, and then, when he was 16, he became an apprentice to his uncle's linen drapery. Four years later, he returned to Delft to set himself up as a draper and maintained so for the rest of his 91 years. He was also appointed as chamberlain to the Delft Council in 1660 and was one of the trustees of the estate of the artist Jan Vermeer. I think this is Vermeer was the person in the girl in the pearl earring. I love that type of stuff. He married his wife Barbara when he was 22. He had five children before Barbara died 12 years later. But only one of them, his daughter Maria, survived. He married again. His second wife died too. And when she did, Maria moved in to her father and cared for him with utter devotion for the rest of his life. The little household in Delft was completed with a long-haired dog, a talking parrot, and a quiet horse. Isn't that beautiful? What a beautiful thing. And you do see that... people have heaps of children, all this amazing stuff. Homemade microscopes. Leeuwenhoek was probably inspired to take up microscopy sometime around 1668, after seeing a copy of Hooke's Micrographium, which was very popular at the time, though he may have already been using the lens to examine cloth, most likely. Unlike Hooke, Leeuwenhoek did not use a two-lens compound microscope, but a single high-quality lens which could be described simply as a magnifying glass rather than a microscope. At the time, such simple microscopics were much easier to get a clear picture. Problems with blurring meant it was impossible to make compound microscope magnified more than 20 or 30 times. But Leeuwenhoek was able to grind his own single-lens microscopes, and after years of honing his techniques, and with the help of his acute eyesight and careful lighting, he was able to see things clearly in the magnification well over 200 times, something no one else managed to achieve for almost two centuries. Leeuwenhoek is known to have made more than over 500 of these single-lens microscopes, but only 10 today survive. They are very simple devices, just a few inches long, with a lens mounted in a tiny hole in a brass plate. The specimen is mounted on a point that sticks up from the lens. Two screws move the specimen into focus. All else is needed is careful lighting and a very steady, sharp eye. Letters to the Royal Society. After a few years of perfecting the little microscopes, Leeuwenhoek began examining things such as mould and insects of incredible close-up and seeing for the first time the complex structure of a bee's eyes, for instance. In 1673, Leeuwenhoek contacted the Dutch physician anatomist Reinoud de Graaf to tell him what he had found. Though just 32, de Graaf was already famous for the discovery of the egg-making sites and follicles in the human body, which now bear his name. De Graaf wrote to Henry Eulenburg, president of the Royal Society in London, the hub of 17th century science, about his fellow Dutchman and his marvellous microscope. Because of de Graaf's reputation, Eulenburg once invited Leeuwenhoek to write a letter to the Royal Society reporting his findings to be published in the Philosophical Transactions, the Society's journal. For For the humble Dutch draper, the invitation was undoubtedly rather overwhelming. It was a letter accompanying the report that he wrote that he had never tried to publish his results because he was not sure he could express himself effectively. Nor could he speak Latin, the international language of scientists at the time. He wrote in Dutch and got a local man to translate it into Latin. Letters were sent in Dutch and translated into English. Leeuwen's early observations were nothing startling, and this first letter reported no more than what Hooke had seen a decade earlier. But it was well enough received, and Leeuwen was encouraged to continue his work and go on sending letters to society. In fact, he went on sending 50 of them, sending them for 50 years and sent more reports than any member of the society before or since. Amicules, which is little war bugs. Although Leeuwenhoek's first letter had not reported anything dramatic, he was perfecting his technique. Then, in 1674, he reported seeing little creatures in lake water. Quote, I found floating herein diverse earthly particles, some green streaks, spiraling wound serpentine, all arranged after the manner of copper or tin worms, which distillers use to cool their liquors and distill over. The whole circumference of each of these streaks is about the thickness of one of the hair on one's head. The most remarkable letter was letter 18, the letter in October 1676, in which he reports the discovery of what is now called bacteria in drops of water. And there's a page in there. But his discoveries did not stop there. In 1677, he described how he examined his own semen. And it's rather funny for him to write about it. This, too, was swarming with the little animals we now call sperm. But, unlike the creatures in rainwater, the animalcules, tiny animals, in semen were all identical. Each of the many thousands he looked at had the same tiny head and nothing else. But he would see them swimming like tadpoles in the semen. It was too much for the others to believe, and it was decades before Leeuwen's description of semen was accepted, sperm accepted. A mouthful of life. In letter 39, so this is in 1683, Leeuwen reports how he examined his own saliva and plaque scraped from his teeth. This is saliva contains no amicules, but the plaque is teeming with them. It's pretty amoving, the biggest sort, he says, and very strong and swift motion, and shot about like a pike through the water. The second shot, oftentimes spun around like a top, were a far more number. He also says the plaque taken from his teeth after he began drinking scalding coffee and contain no amicules, and concludes the heat of the coffee probably kills the little amicules. He confirmed this when he found the amicules in the plaque, taken from his own back teeth and not exposed directly to coffee. A little later, Leeuwen became close to realizing bacteria can be germs that cause disease when he noticed a dramatic increase in the number of amicules in his mouth when he was ill and had a rotting tooth. People have sometimes been disappointed that Leeuwen did not take one step forward and identify bacteria as germs. It took another century before Louis Pasteur made the first step. But in many ways, Leeuwen's understanding was closer to our modern view of bacteria and is important, often beneficial role they play in the world as well as the germs. By the time he died in the 26th of August, 1723, Leeuwenhoek was modestly famous. The Holy Roman Emperor had visited his house to see his microscopic marvels, and so too has Queen Mary of England, and many other notable people. I think Mary of England was in Scotland, you know, with the Stuarts. That's Mary Stuart. Is it Anne or Mary? No, I'm confused there. But he never saw anything more than a quiet life with his daughter at a microscope. Dogs and cats, I suppose. Several years before his death, he made a beautiful wooden cabinet to hold his best microscopes and specimens. When he died, his daughter Maria sent this to the Royal Society as he had requested. And there it stayed a century before mysteriously disappearing, only for various items to reappear in recent years. Despite his achievements, Leeuwen was quickly forgotten, and it was his devoted daughter who later erected a tiny one for him in Delft, commemorating his great discovery. So if I was in Delft, I'd like to go and see that. I really enjoyed seeing Delft. They had the Dutch dog infantry. So rather than cavalry, they had dogs carrying machine guns. It was quite good to see. Discovering bacteria. Owen's famous letter, Leeuwenhoek's famous letter 18, has 17 and a half pages long and begins modestly enough as he goes through his scientific diary of the previous year. In the year 1675, about halfway through September, I discovered little creatures in the rain which had stood for a few days in a tiny tub that was painted blue within. Leeuwenhoek thought that it was worth exploring what else might be in the water, as he said. These little animals, to my eyes, were more than 10,000 times smaller than the water flea and water louse, which you can see alive and moving with naked eye. He describes how he went on examining water from different sources, rainwater, pond water, sea water, well water, and so on, each left exposed to the air before he examined them. Each time he saw some of these incredibly tiny creatures, he was especially interested in those deemed to have legs and tails that allow them to scurry about in the water. And when some of the animals bestirred themselves, they sometimes stuck out two little horns which were continuously moved after the fashion of a horse's ear. It's not entirely certain what these creatures were, though he might be guessed they are bacteria. But Leeuwenhoek describes how he examined water that had been infused with ground pepper, and what he saw was there was clearly bacteria. The little creatures moved so little that he was not always sure they were alive, but there were enough cues. The idea that there were tens of thousands of tiny creatures in a single drop of water was so astounding that Henry Orlenberg asked Leeuwenhoek to provide independent witness to verify his findings. The rapper invited several of Delft's most respectable citizens, including the vicar, to look in the microscope. They confirmed what he saw. A year later, Hook, too, confirmed the findings of his own observation performed in front of great expert witnesses, including Christopher Wren, the architect of London's St. Paul Cathedral. How are we doing for time? 32 minutes. Robert Hook. Poor Robert. One of the saddest people. Robert Hooke, 1635-1703, is one of the great unsung heroes of science. He made crucial contributions in almost every branch of scientific revolution in the 17th century, yet remains a shadowy, little-known figure, thanks to Newton, my addition. Most people know of Hooke's name only because of the law of elasticity, how things stretch and squeeze, which bears his name. That is, the force is proportional to the displacement. So you displace something twice as much as twice as much force. This is an important law, but it's just one tiny example of Hooke's overall contribution to science. The sheer range of Hooke's activity is quite astonishing, and some experts have described him as English Leonardo da Vinci, who is perhaps the most practical and inventive of all great scientists. And his range of inventions matches, if not surpasses, his theoretical ideas. Among Hooke's many inventions were the ear trumpet, first practical spirit level, sash windows, balancing experiments, escarpments and cocks, aerometer for measuring the wind speed, hygrometer for measuring humidity, the wheel barometer for showing how air pressure varies, the crosshairs for the sights of the telescopes and later gun sights, the iris diaphragm, later the aperture of cameras, the micro dots for secret messages, respirators and for easy breathing, a diving well, an air pump, and the universe joint, now widely used in car drive shafts, a self-stabilizing keel for boats, an early form of sonar, mercury anagram, used later for dental amalgam, for dental fillings, the micrometer, the air gun. The list goes on and on. Like Leonardo, Hooke worked on a flying machine and even anticipated the coming of the steam engine. Not for nothing did his friend, the famous diarist John Aubrey, describe him as certainly the greatest mechanic of the K in his day in the world. So we'll just read through that, take a break for a sec. Hooke was by no means just an ingenious technician. He was also a visionary scientist. He is known to have collaborated with the most great scientists of his day, Boyle, Newton, Huygens, Enoch, Wren, and many others, and clearly contributed a great deal to their work. But much of the record of Hooke's work is lost, so his contribution is not always clear or recognised, even at the time. Some, like Boyle, freely acknowledge Hooke's valuable role in helping formulate his famous gas laws. Newton, however, fought long and bitterly with Hooke over just who came up with the crucial idea that the force of gravity diminishes at the square of the distance between things, the inverse square law. The evidence points to Hooke's favour, but Newton's effectively obliterated the record of Hooke's role in the work. In some areas, though, Hooke's contribution is incontestable. He was the great pioneer of microscope studies, coining the word cell for the microscopic packet in which living things are built. His book Micrographia was the greatest book of the age of the microscopic world, and an inspiration for men as diverse as Leeuwenhoek and diarist Samuel Phelps. Pepys. He was also the founder of the scientific science of metrology, showing how to measure atmospheric quantities like wind speed, air pressure, and suggesting how accurate record keeping could lead to weather forecasting. As if all this was enough, Hooke was a major architect, not only collaborated with Sir Christopher Wren in rebuilding the London of the Great Fire of 1666, but designing many buildings in his own rights. In his the famous Monument of the Fire in London, the world's tallest Greek-style column, is thought to have been designed by him. So, too, was the great palace-like Bethlehem Hospital, now destroyed, and maybe famous Whispering Gallery at St. Paul's, too. Young Hooke, Robert Hooke, was born on 18th of July 1635 at Freshwater of the Isle of Wight. He later described his early childhood as charmed and trouble-free, but in fact it was marred by smallpox, which left him scarred for life. His mother is nowhere mentioned in later recollections. He seems to have spent a lot of time alone, wandering the chalk landscape of the Isle of Wight, which is how he may have gained his first knowledge of fossils. The great tragedy of young Robert's childhood happened when he was just 11 years old. This was the suicide of his clergyman father, who lost his living in the wake of the Royalist defeat of the English Civil War. Robert was left with a small legacy of £40, maybe with the help of neighbours, or maybe entirely of his own initiative. He travelled to London to Royal Printers and Studio of London, England's most accomplished painters, Peter Lely, who was famous for the portraits of Charles I. After a year or so, in which he learned the valuable drawing skills, he needed a proper education and used his legacy to enroll at Westminster School. The school's formidable headmaster, Richard Busby, recognised that he had something special on his hands when 13-year-old Robert read all of Euclid's work in a week. Well, there you go. Busby became the young Hooke's patron and helped ensure his progress to Oxford University, where he paid his way with Coral Scholarship. It is while at Oxford in the late 1650s that Hooke met the famous Irish chemist Robert Boyle, and for a while became Boyle's assistant. Boyle's request, Hooke came up with ingenious design for air pump, which allowed Boyle to show how, as gas compressed, the pressure increases in proportion, and so formulated his famous gas law. Hooke's design provided the basis for the design of air pumps even today. So I wonder what it is. It would be nice if they had it here. The Royal Society. Boyle and Hooke formed a nucleus of brilliant scientists at the Gresham College in Oxford, who were to create the world's most famous scientific society, the Royal Society. When the society was launched in 1662, Boyle ensured that Hooke was appointed the first curator of experiments. This post, which for many years was unpaid, meant that Hooke was expected to give practical experiments at every meeting of the society. It's hard to imagine anyone but Hooke willing to fulfil such an arduous brief or making such an astonishing success of it. In response to the society demands, Hooke came up with a greater wealth of original scientific ideas and practical demonstrations than anyone else before or since. It seemed to suit Hooke's agile mind to leap from one task to another with amazing rapidity, but it may be why he never developed any one single idea to the point that he became lastingly famous for. So he was actually the lab jack for the lab assistant for the Royal Society. It's an interesting story. The battle with Newton. The British dispute was that with this Newton. When Newton made his theory of light and colour known in 1672, Hogg pointed out that it was right in Newton's that what was right in Newton's theory had been suggested by him 7 years previously. He also argued that light did not travel as particles but as waves, an idea credited to the Dutch scientist Huygens. The battle began and lines began to draw between these two giants of science, like two autistic people going clash on. When Newton first mentioned his ideas on gravity in the 1680s, he suggested that gravity was constant, that is, the same strength everywhere. Hooke suggested elliptical course of planets might be better explained if gravity was not constant, if they obeyed the square law diminishing as the square distance between objects. But of course Hooke had as yet no proof of his idea, even though a decade early he made important observations to prove it using the Zenith telescope in his room at Oxford. In response to Hooke's publication, Hooke wrote a great book, Principalia, over the next few years, in which he proved the mathematical proofs of gravity does indeed obey the inverse square law. So it's interesting that Newton, of a number of things, he requires a foil to hate. As Newton came to a point of published Principalia, Hooke insisted that the Royal Society be properly credited with his key theoretical cornerstone of Newton's work. Newton was incensed and immediately deleted virtually all reference to Hooke in the book. In the famous post, Newton is quoted in an old Latin rhetorical tag, "Merely because one says something could be so, it does not follow that it is so," implying the credit should go entirely to the scientists who proved the idea. Newton was, by such a time, a powerful figure that his vindictive view of Hooke stuck, and even today most people still go along with Newton's uncharitable view that the dilettante Hooke lacked the solid science and mathematics to convert the gloomy theory into a solid proven fact. Oh, poor Hooke. So we've got Van Leeuwen. Who's the person from before? Huygens died of depression. Let's read here. As Hooke grew older, he became increasingly depressed and withdrawn. This is not enough for Newton, though. So deep was Newton's hatred of Hooke, it is said, that when Newton became president of the Royal Society, he destroyed the portraits of Hooke that hang there. By the time he reached his 60s, Hooke was a physical and emotional wreck. Some of it was undoubtedly down to the stress in this battle of Newton, but a lot was self-inflicted. He had lived a punishing pace all his life, working through night after night on experiments. He had tried many experiments on his own body and then taken their toll. Moreover, to keep up the impossible pace, he set himself again and again with stimulant drugs. It couldn't last. His final months were a time of physical deterioration, isolation by one of his best friends fell away. Isolation as one by one of his best friends fell away. Unable to cope with his bouts of paranoia, he died alone in Christian College rooms on the 3rd of March, 1703, attended only by a young maid. Isn't that just absolutely classic? Okay, there's a square on Micrographia. When Hooke published his great book, Micrographia, it caused immediate sensation and perhaps the first popular science book in history. The famous diarist Phelps obtained a copy as soon as he could and wrote, quote, "Before I went to bed, I sat up until 2 o'clock in my chamber reading Hooke's Microscopical Observations, the most ingenious book I've ever read in my life." Hooke was probably the first scientist to use a microscope to study microscopic detail, using a first-class compound microscope he made for himself. He studied organisms as diverse as insects, sponges, formula. Micrographia is a meticulous and detailed record of his observations and includes his own superb drawings of what he saw through his microscope. He is the first to see clearly such things as scales on a flea's body and the minute hairs on flies' legs. His most famous observation was of a thin slice of cork, which he wrote, quote, "I could exceedingly plainly perceive it to be perforated and porous, much like a honeycomb, but that the pores were regular. These pores, or cells, were indeed the first microscopical pores ever seen, and perhaps that were ever seen." In fact, as we know, Hooke was discovering living cells, which he named because it reminded him of the cells of a monastery. Hooke also studied fossils and noted similarities between petrified wood and fossil shells and living wood and living shells, and went on to make the first suggestion of the process of fossilization, which minerals gradually displace living tissues to turn a dead organism into stone. He later went further, suggesting that seashell fossils found in high mountains indicate the past world was subjected to massive earthquakes, which drew up the ancient seabeds of the mountains. Hooker even thought that some of these fossils might be species of creatures that no longer existed. Such ideas were way ahead of their time, and only came to prominence in the Great Revolution, which transformed geology and formed the basis of Darwin's theory of evolution almost 200 years later. Sir Isaac Newton. By universal consent, sorry, he's from 1642 to 1727. By universal consent, Isaac Newton, 1642 to 1727, was the greatest scientist of all time. He's the most famous for discovering gravity and for his three great laws of motion which underpin all modern physics. But he's also created the mathematics of calculus, unlocked the secrets of coloured light, and much more besides. So let's go into that. Hooke was probably involved in gravity, and the three great laws of motion he said were generally known already. So he puts them together, but it is interesting to look at it. We take Newton's views of the way things move so much for granted nowadays that it's hard to imagine just how revolutionary they were in Newton's day and just what an extraordinary breakthrough they were. Before Newton, there had been no notion of movement of fish in a sea of papers distributed by the breeze, had anything the sea of papers disturbed by the breeze had anything in common whatsoever with the movement of the heavens, let alone that they were predictable in any way. They were seen as controlled by unique local factors, or else by the whim of the gods, the universe essentially a mysterious, capricious place. With his laws of gravity and his three laws of motion, Newton showed that every movement, large or small, on the ground or in the first reaches of space, behaves according to a simple principle, universal laws. That's an important thing, that they are universal laws. In his book, and it's interesting that Archimedes had two laws, for Earth and one in the heavens, and so it's going through. But it's interesting that in the finding that it produced theories of time, which Newton's adopted, which weren't the correct theories. It's interesting. The mathematical principles of the natural philosophy, or simply Principia, the greatest science book ever written, he suddenly blew away the universe's... Oh, gosh. It's got a poem, and it's just really hard to read. I don't know why this person says this. He suddenly blew away the universe's chaotic mystery and showed that everything elsewhere behaves in an orderly and timely understandable way. It was as if the whole universe had been revealed at last as some great, incredibly complex clockwork machine, and Newton's law were the key to its workings. Incredibly, it was shown that the laws worked without experiments in laboratories here on the ground can be applied right across the universe. Even more magnificently, the Principia showed that how every single movement in the universe can be analysed mathematically, and Newton provided the mathematical tools for doing it. With two branches of mathematics, he created differential and integral calculus. Again, it's not so he wrote equations, he wrote incredibly complex sentences. It became possible not to just work out what was going on in any movement from the lifting of a coffee cup to the orbit of a planet, but to predict what would happen, for instance, a train goes across a bridge or when a spacecraft is launched. Newton made it possible, in theory, to predict the movement of everything in the universe forever, from the greatest star to the tiniest molecule. Yeah, in theory, but then you've got chaos and Hamiltonians and stuff like that. No wonder when... then that Newton's ideas began to be widely understood, he became to be regarded as the awe in the 18th century. Although, who was it? There were people concerned about him. I'm just really trying to think of that He's a philosopher. He lived in Germany. He was anti-Newtonian. He was concerned. There was Leibniz, but there was also, the thought's gone to me. Who is that philosopher? Very important philosopher. I really can't summon his name into my head. Okay, no wonder when Newton's ideas began to be widely understood, he was regarded as in awe in the 18th century. Gee, I wish I could remember. A German one. It'll come to my mind. His revelation that the universe behaves according to predictable Kant, Immanuel Kant, that's the main important thing. His revelation that the universe behaves according to predictable universal laws ushered in a new optimistic age of enlightenment, in which people believe that humankind can learn and understand and improve the world. As per Alexander Pope, in his famous satirical voice, nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light. And his optimism seems clouded today. If this optimism seems clouded today, it's only the doubts that we will do the right thing, not the things that are ultimately beyond the understanding the way Newton initiated. And if Einstein's discoveries have shown subtler, deeper insights as to how the universal law works at extremes, Newton's laws underpin our basic understanding of how things work in everyday scales. Well, you know, I really thoroughly object to it. It's sort of like Newton is Einstein ultralight. I think that's what we would say. It's a descriptive. I feign no hypothesis. It's a purely descriptive science, and people were so enthralled by it. At the end of the discussion, people were so exhausted they didn't know it was descriptive with scientists. The young genius. Isaac Newton was born on Christmas Day in 1642 in a small manor house of the Lincolnshire village of Woolstot. He was premature, quote, so little they could fit him in about a quart pot, and so sickly he was not expected to survive. In fact, he proved remarkably healthy to live to 84 years. His father was already dead by the time Newton was born. When he was just 18 months old, his poor widowed mother married a wealthy local minister in the nearby North Witham, but left the infant Isaac with his grandparents. It may be that Isaac never recovered from his early abandonment. It's definite. He used to bash people up. He was a really angry man. Even though his mother returned home to her son when her new husband died 7 years later, Isaac confessed that he remembered threatening my stepfather and mother to burn them in the house over them. Though throughout his life, Newton carried a terrible suppressed anger and sense of resentment that made him a very difficult man to deal with. He was just a complete arsehole. The introverted Isaac went to school at the age of 12, but showed no signs of any intellectual prowess until he was bullied one day at school. A towering rage, the young Newton fought back until the larger employment was a quivering wreck. But Newton did not stop there. He was determined to humiliate his opponent in every classroom too. Soon he became deeply involved in academic pursuits, especially science, and amazed the locals with such things as handmade water clocks and flying lamps. When I say flying lamps, these are burning kites at night. People are terrified at nights. Okay. Recognizing the boy's talents, Newton's teacher, John Stokes, and his uncle, William Ashcroft, encouraged him to try for Cambridge. Oh, no, that's not quite true. They brought him on the farm first, and he made adults as a farmer. Encouraged him, and he was accepted in a place in 1661 when he was 19. By this time, Newton had also concerned to follow up his own research that he barely bothered with the coursework and was almost failed. Unknown to his tutors, though, he was already going far beyond them, developing the latest revolutionary mathematical and scientific ideas of the French genius René Descartes, which were only just beginning to filter into England. So if I want to say, Principalia, if you read Principalia and you don't have Latin, that's crap. And if you don't realise that all his work, Principalia is a discussion against René Descartes. Otherwise, it's incomprehensible, and it's not the greatest book. But anyway, these people just have to say these things. They're forced to say it. The miraculous year in August 1665, plague struck right across southern England. Cambridge was effectively closed, and Newton was forced to return to Woolshope, where he remained for a year. This enforced retirement turned out to be a truly astonishing year. In the peace and quiet of Lincolnshire home, Newton developed his work of Descartes to create a mathematical calculus, which studies how fast things change, and essential for the understanding of acceleration, in which his forces work. Calculus, which Newton called his method of fluxions, I love that, took Archimedes' brilliant way of using polygons and rectangles to work out the areas of circles and curves, and pushed it one giant step further to show how an arrangement or slope of any point of a curve or graph can be analysed, such as one showing time against distance travelled. In that way, the speed and acceleration at any given moment can be analysed. Yeah, I think that's an important point, that that there was no concept of speed. The distance and time were separate objects. So the synthetic concept, a concept of distance per time, was not done by the Greeks, because it was just impossible to think. And so it's impossible to actually state to the modern mind what Newton's revolution was, because the modern mind has never tasted the segregation of ideas of the ancient Greeks. It's one of those, you know, it's crazy things they're teaching at school. So all we wind up is teaching you that Newton's great and you're dumb. Shut up and listen. Okay. Newton's greatest discoveries were the law of gravity, the law of motion, and he added a third while Stalbert Marker, he picked up a pair of glass prisms. Yeah, that's interesting. And began to research the nature of light and colours, using prisms to split data into colours and rainbow, and then using another to recombine them into white light. He showed that white light is made up of a rainbow of colours. Remarkably, for all his scientific discoveries during his time in Woodhope, this was the only he revealed his return to Cambridge the following year. It was, so he has his dog called Diamond. It was enough, though, to earn him the post of Leicestrian Professor of Mathematics in 1669. Newton remained a secretive all his life, writing reams of research findings, only showing them when challenged or when someone seemed about to come to the same conclusion as him. I think he was generally an autistic savant, and so the ideas were not set as we understand ideas. Ideas were holographically stored in some memory. That's my view, having to only the slightest affect the same type of brain. The turbulent scientist. The secrecy was to cause him tremendous problems in the future. It took him 30 years to publish his work on calculus, for instance. The intervening period, the German philosopher Leibniz had published his own independently discovered version, given the name calculus, which stuck. But, you know, this was so confused. The railroad, who got there first, became so bitter the Royal Society held an inquiry to sort out the mess. Newton hijacked the committee's report to ensure it found in his favour, in which he'd done anyway. Even so, Newton's furious trials against Leibniz went on even after the German philosopher's dead. And, of course, the British took over Leibniz's boss as king, and Newton said, "You cannot bring Leibniz, your faithful servant, over to England." Similarly, he was stung. It was also really interesting. The Leibniz came up with the digital calculus due to philosophy, digital mathematics or binary mathematics. He was only stung into publishing his ideas on gravity and motion when his scientific rival in England, Robert Hooke, claimed it in 1684. And he solved the planetary motion problem with the inverse law, governed the way planets move. Hooke was right about the inverse square law, but had no notion of why it worked, or even how to prove it. It was his determination to put Hooke in his place that Newton realized this idea of gravity and the law of motion, which he so far had only applied on Earth, might work in the heavens too. He sat down on the work of Principalia, his masterpiece of Principalia, which was finished 30 months later. God, yeah, it's a completely rubbish book. And it's interesting, you know, it's really interesting to read the poem at this time. By this time, Newton was already famous for his remarkable telescope, which he had made in 1668. Now, one of the telescopes and lenses were already well-developed and getting quite big in Newton's day. Problem was, the bigger they got, the more they suffered from distorted colour fringes and the light rays that meant through the glass and the lens. Newton solved the problem by swapping the lenses for curved mirrors so the light rays did not have to pass through glass, but simply reflected off it, or of mirrors. This also doubled the light back on itself, making the telescope much more compact. The Newtonian telescope would be just 15 centimetres long, yet as powerful as a lens telescope a metre long, and avoided the problems of colour fringings. Newton's fame. The invention of the telescope that got Newton elected to the prestigious Royal Society, the leading scientific society of Europe, and gathering a place of all finest minds in Britain. But almost as soon as he had been elected, he resigned in a bitter row of Robert Hooke over papers that Newton wrote detailing his work on prisons, which Hooke wrongly criticised. Newton vowed never to return to the society while Hooke was there. It was only when Hooke died in 1703 that Newton returned to be president and remained there until he died in 1723. The Principalia, published in 1687, caused a sensation and made Newton internationally famous. Indeed, it was the first scientific superstar. He was elected MP for Cambridge and, when he came to London to do his sessions of Parliament, he found himself feted by everyone from the King to the great philosopher John Locke, and surrounded by young accolades. One of these accolades was a gifted young Swiss mathematician, Fatio Di Giulia. Oh dear, he's a puffy one, isn't he? This 48-year-old Newton is said to have fallen in love with Fatio. When Fatio left for Switzerland 3 years later, Newton was destroyed. There is no way of knowing if this is merely coincidence, but from this time on, Newton never embarked on any more scientific work, and for a while became increasingly inclusive, concentrating on alchemy, and that he regarded as, if anything, more important than his scientific report. Things. This is really interesting. Now, Newton had people executed. Let's get this absolutely fair. In 1696, Newton was invited by the Royal Mint. The official story is that the Byzantine was a reward for his intellectual achievements. The famous French philosopher Voltaire believed it was simply because he had a pretty niece married to the right person. And all that's interesting at Voltaire. I think that is true, that he was pimping out his niece. Whatever the truth, Newton embarked on the job with fanatical zeal, determined to stamp out counterfeiting of coins that was undermining the English currency. Newton remained the post of Master of the Mint for the rest of his life. After Hooke died, Newton combined it with the post of President of the Royal Society, a task he pursued with the same vigour. Though he is now in his 60s, Newton died on the 20th of March, 1723. He was buried at the grand funeral at Westminster Abbey and attended by the great dignitaries of the day. Huge crowds came to Cottage Pass. Voltaire was visiting London at the time and wrote, "England honours a mathematician as a nation honours a king who has done well for his subjects." It was true. Okay, there's three boxes here. Newton's Great Laws. The story goes that the inspiration of the idea of gravity came from Newton's one late summer day in 1660 when he sat thinking in the garden of Wauchope and saw an apple drop from a tree. So it's never known until after he was dead and Newton's sister spoke with Voltaire to put that through. It's often dismissed as legend, but Newton himself claimed it was so, okay, that's pretty dodgy. It's not entirely clear that a falling apple made him think, but Newton's real insight was the understanding just why it fell. In previous half-century, Kepler had shown that planets had elliptical oval orbits, and Galileo had shown things accelerate at an even pace as they fall towards the ground. Yet no one had thought of connecting the two events, let alone showing these had the same universal cause. Newton realised the apple was not just falling because it was pulled by an invisible force. The latter wondered if the same force might be holding the planets in orbits. Just as gravity pulls the apple to Earth, so gravity keeps the moon in its orbit around the Earth and the planets around the Sun and stops them flying into space. From a simple but brilliant idea, Newton developed his theory of gravity, a universal force that tries to pull matter together. With his mathematics, so I profane no hypothesis, and it's a universal force, but we now say, well, that's not really necessary. Things are unaware of this force. If nothing is touching, there's no force on it. It's just the curve, the space is curved. With a mathematical proof, it showed that the force must be the same everywhere. And we pull between two things depends on their mass and the amount of matter between them. Square of the distance between them. He didn't prove it. Okay. Over the next 20 years, Newton refined his idea of gravitation into a system that included three great laws of motion. The first law is the idea of inertia momentum. It basically means that things keep moving at the same speed. In certain lines on this, something pushes or pulls them in that force. This applies to the moon, showing that the moon tries to carry on a straight line, but gravity pulls it into an orbit. Oh, God. The second law is the idea that the rate of direction of change depends entirely on the strength of forces that changes it, and how the object is affected. If the moon were close to the Earth, the pull of gravity then would be stronger, so the moon would be dragged down to crash. Oh, this disastrous. If it were further away, gravity would be too weak, the moon would fly off into space. The third law showed that every action and reaction are equal or opposite. So the two things crash together, they'll be bounced off one another. Now, he actually did not say that. He said of transfer of momentum, and then the forces done later. That's a dreadful book. I hate that. And the thing is that people will read that. Students will read that. So Newton's equal and opposite force, he said that things, the momentum is neither created or destroyed. Momentum is conserved. So you get that. Newton on light. In 1704, Newton's book Optics suggested that a beam of light is a stream of pounded particles or corpuscles travelling at a huge speed. If so, he argued, this would explain why light can travel through vacuum, where there's nothing to carry it. It also explained, he believed, why light travels in straight lines between cast sharp shadows, and is reflected by mirrors, the tiny particles bouncing just off like tennis balls. He thought the bending or refraction of light might be caused by corpuscles travelling faster than in the glass than in the water. Yeah. Around the same time, the Dutch scientist Christian Huygens came up with an equally convincing but wholly contradictory theory that light travels in waves and ripples on a pond. Most particles between them, they started a debate, which is still not completely resolved. Oh, God, that makes me upset. The current thinking suggests that they're right at different times. Oh, that's ridiculously poorly expressed. The light travels in space because space is not void, it's vacuum, it's got a capacitance and inductance. Newton the alchemist. Isaac Newton is generally considered to be the first great modern scientist. His book Principia was the first of all the most important scientific achievements in the past 300 years. I'm going to have to stop this, but it's interesting to look at how John Maynard Keynes really investigated him as an alchemist. I'll read some more soon. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.